And so does Tubular Bells, the album. Roast bread with cheese and red wine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. A little cheese board while you listen to 48 minutes of insanity.
Why not? Why not?
Welcome to Electric Enthusiasm, the podcast where we celebrate unironic enthusiasm. I'm like, that's totally tubular, man. Katie Cobalt. Because, like, that's, like, the only thing I know about the word tubular.
It's tubular, yeah. And I'm Alexander Kilv, and if I'm sitting here sweating, if you're watching this on YouTube and I seem really hot, it's because it's a super hot day in Copenhagen. I'm not sick or anything. It's not a fever. I swear to God, it's not COVID. It's just a really, really warm day here.
I feel like if it was COVID, podcasting is like the safest social distance activity, considering we're in two different countries.
Very true. Very true.
So, Alex, tell us how this works. I totally forgot what I was going to say.
Yes, Katie. In each episode, one of us presents a topic that they love. I have one today that I love so much, but that the other one knows little or nothing about, and then tries their hardest to spread that enthusiasm to the other host and to you, the listener. Occasionally, we'll have guests on who are super excited about something that we know nothing about.
And then we have the moment of meta, where we nerd out about enthusiasm and talk about why it matters and how you can live a more enthusiastic life.
And you should share your enthusiasm with us, because enthusiasm matters. Tell us what you're excited about these days. Go to our Instagram, @electricenthusiasm, or our website, electricenthusiasm.com. You could even plain old send us an email at hello@electricenthusiasm.com. People do, and we love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What on earth are tubular bells?
Yeah, this is the part where I ask you. So, Katie, what do you know about tubular bells?
I believe they are bells, which are shaped like tubes.
Want to do the multiple choice thing?
Yes!
Yes! Okay, cool. Okay, so is tubular bells a musical instrument consisting of a set of hanging metal cylinders that you strike with a wooden hammer? Is it B, the name of one of the 747 airplanes in the Virgin Atlantic fleet? Or is it C, a music album from the 1970s?
I'm going to go for the secret answer D and say all of the above.
Yes! Again, you nailed it.
Because I always feel like you're trying to trick me. I feel like when you go for multiple choice, you're doing it because you have a sneaky, sneaky thing up your sleeves. And I'm like,
yes.
I shall not be outsneaked. I will not be outsneaked.
Outsnuck? Outsnooked? Outsnookered? I don't know.
Outsnooked.
Yeah, outsnooked. Yeah, I like that. You're entirely correct. It is all three. And believe it or not, those three answers are connected.
Yay. Yay. I'm excited to find out why.
Yes, but what we're talking about is the album.
Cool.
That's sort of the main focus, but we're going to get the other two answers in there as well.
I love a good by the way. Love a good by the way.
Yes.
So, Alex, what should a person know about the album Tubular Bells? What are the facts?
It is the debut studio album by an English musician and composer called Mike Oldfield. It came out on May 25, 1973. This album is 49 years old. Turns 50 next year, yeah. And it is the first album ever released on Virgin Records. That'll give you a hint of the connection to the Virgin Atlantic plane. We're going to get back to that. It became the number one selling album in the UK in 1973, and it stayed in the top 10 for a year. It's a hugely influential album. Has sold millions of copies all over the world. And it is a very well-respected album. I have two quotes that I'd like you to read that'll give you an idea of the influence of this particular album. This is from a review just as the album came out.
A new recording of such strength and beauty that to me it represents the biggest breakthrough into history that any musician has made. Whoa.
Yeah.
That is a bold statement. That's right? A very bold statement.
Right? That album is spectacular. Try reading the next quote, also from a review when it came out.
Tubular Bells is a superlative record. I love the word superlative as an aside. Such a great word. Which owes nothing to contemporary whims. It is one of the most mature, vital, rich, and humorous pieces of music to have emerged from the pop idiom. Okay, side note, whoever wrote the second quote, the use of language, like both superlative, excellent word, A+, and also the pop idiom.
Yes.
I do a subtle golf clap to said writer. Fabulous use of English.
Would you say that superlative is a superlative word?
It is.
It is, right. So you might get the sense that this album was a pretty big deal when mm-hmm. it came out, and it absolutely was. It has been hugely influential. And because it's so different, it paved the way for later different music, like, for instance, Bohemian Rhapsody, which came out in 1975, so 2 years later. That might yeah. not have happened, but they might not have allowed Queen to do that if this album hadn't existed first and become yeah. such a hit with critics and commercially. Yeah.
I really need to hear it. Is it just bells?
No, it's not. It's very much not just bells. We are going to play some snippets of the album. I will say this, though. This is not an album that you necessarily love the first time you hear it. Be prepared for that. This is music that's a little bit challenging, but we're going to play some parts of it just to get a sense of what it's like, because it's like nothing else.
What I really enjoy about you, Alex, is that your enthusiasm for music that's not fun is great. Like, you just, like, the genre of music that you seem to be attracted to is, like, it's like olives. Like, some people are not going to like this, but mm-hmm. or Marmite. Like, you like the Marmite of music.
That's not a bad comparison. I kind of like that. And I will say this is probably some of the most challenging music that I still not only enjoy, but absolutely love.
So why are we talking about, like, okay, beyond your addiction to Marmite music, why this album, Alex?
Well, I obviously didn't get it in 1973 when it came out. I was 5 years old at the time, but I did buy it as a teenager. And this music has been with me my entire adult life. I have no idea how many times I've heard this album. This is an album that you sit down and you listen to with focus. It's not music you can put on in the background. That's a waste of time. I love it so much. Just hearing the opening phrase from side one just instantly puts me in a fantastic mood, because it's so good. It is so good. And I have five reasons why this album is amazing. Do you want to hear them?
Yes, please.
Okay. Unsurprisingly, reason number one is the music. Marmite is not a bad comparison in that some people love it and some people hate it, and that's perfectly fine. It's like nothing else. The record is 49 minutes, but there are no songs. There's a part one and a part two, but that's mainly dictated by the fact that it came out on vinyl in 1973, right? There are no songs. There are no lyrics. There is nothing you could possibly make a single from. So that makes it a little bit different than anything else. It's time to hear some of it.
Yes, please. I'm so curious. This is so weird.
We're just going to start from the beginning, from the intro to part one. Listen to a little bit of this. Tell me what you think. And also see if you can figure out what time this is, what time signature is. What the hell is this?
As just a note to the audience, I might be a dancer. I am not a musician.
Yeah, me neither. But see if you can figure it out. You can count to four.
I can count to eight.
You can count to eight. As a dancer, you can count to eight. Exactly.
I don't know if you've ever seen me try and count an amount of items, but it's hilarious because sometimes I'll go 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, oh, and then realize what I've done and have to start over. I count in eights now.
That is hilarious.
It's real bad. That's Anyways, hilarious. Tubular Bells. It sounds epic. It sounds like it's going to destroy the world, potentially. Or save the universe. It's one or the other, really. Like, is this going to destroy humanity? Is this going to solve all of our problems? It's a tough call for the first 30 seconds.
Yeah.
As for time signature...
Yeah, exactly. The first 3.5 minutes of part one is that repeating theme. More and more music gets layered on top of that. And if you have a hard time figuring out the time signature, everybody does. It changes between 7/8 and 8/8.
That's rude.
Yeah. 15/8. So it's the same. It's the same theme. Do, 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 do. But then the second time it comes, there is an extra note at the end So yeah. It goes from 7/8 to 8/8 and then back and forth, back and forth. It's unexpected. It creates a little bit of a lilt to the music, and it's just absolutely beautiful. 3.5 minutes of that, and then something else comes on, and then something else comes on. New things keep happening in the music all the time. What genre is this? It has rock instrumentation in that there are drums and bass and electric guitar and an electric organ. It also has folk sound. There are clear elements of folk sound in there. But at the same time, it has a structure from classical music and is very much inspired by composers like Ravel or Bach. It changes time signature and keys, kind of like some modern jazz does.
Yeah.
And it has this minimalist repeating themes, like a lot of modern compositions do. It's really a mix of genres. In my opinion, it just transcends genres completely. It also has a lot of experimental instruments or instruments being used in weird ways. One of the instruments that he uses is a double-speed guitar, which is basically an electric guitar recorded at double speed. So it plays at a higher pitch and sounds completely different. So this album breaks new ground in so many ways. This is why I like it, why it's the good kind of Marmite for me, right? It doesn't get too weird. Have you ever heard like 12-tone music or like really weird modern music compositions?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Where it doesn't feel like music. It expands the definition of music to the point where the average person is now questioning what is music.
Exactly.
Which I think is the point of those pieces. I think that's what their goal is.
Yeah.
But not necessarily I want to have it playing when I'm cooking in the kitchen.
Exactly. It stops being music, or if you want to recognize it as music, you have to work for it.
Mm.
I don't enjoy that kind of thing. It's just weird.
I'm totally happy for it to exist. Rule number one, don't yuck someone else's yum. I'm sure somebody out there is like super into it.
Yeah.
And that's great for them. I love that for them.
Exactly. But I think what's so important about Tubular Bells is that it takes all of this weirdness, but it all comes together. Everything resolves. One beautiful melodic theme just flows into the next one. And it seems like there's material here for 10 albums. Just the sheer richness of the composition. There's so much in it. So in conclusion, it good. It real good.
It feels a little bit like meta music. It feels like music that's about music. Because it's pulling from all these different genres and it's pulling from all these different ways of constructing a song. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's comedians who are really funny to other comedians. I feel like this might be like really fascinating to someone who's a musician themselves. Because then they have an understanding of where all these things are coming from. But as a layperson, it's just like, this cool, this good. I don't know why, but it good. To somebody who gets it, this must be like a deeply fascinating journey. But then to me, it's like, pretty sound nice.
In my research for this episode, I did discover a YouTube video where a composer listens to Tubular Bells and talks about what he hears, which is it's phenomenal. And again, it showed me things that I had never heard in 40 years of listening to this album.
But I also think that the way you were experiencing the song in the last however many years it was for your adult life, like that was still a perfectly amazing way to experience the song to enjoy the song and to have that enthusiasm. Like I feel like both levels of appreciation are totally awesome.
Absolutely.
And whatever level of individualism, that's great. I'm very pro people enjoying stuff that they want to enjoy it.
Absolutely. And just one more thing I love about this album is that it does not take itself seriously. I want to play you another little clip because at the very end of the album, this happens.
Punchline. Is this the punchline?
Yeah. What are we listening to?
I don't know the name of the song, but I know the tune. I know the vibe. It's like a folksy, like, it has this like really magical, ethereal buildup, and then it crashes down into like, it feels like I'm having a party in Hobbiton.
Yes, exactly. And to end an otherwise serious composition on that, I think that's just, that's funny. I like that.
That's really good.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So the music is reason number one why I love this album. Reason number two is the composer, Mike Oldfield. Given the complexity of this piece and how rich it is and the sheer inventiveness, would it blow your mind if I told you that he was 19 when he made it?
I don't know if I might pick that up. I quietly said, fuck off.
I heard.
Yeah. What? So did he play the instruments himself or did he have a synthesizer? Like how did he create the music?
He did play most of the instruments himself and did these multi-layer recordings. Here's his background. He was a child musical prodigy. At 10, he picks up a guitar, starts teaching himself. And at 15, he's good enough that he forms a folk duo with his sister and they get an actual record contract. He goes around from gig to gig. He plays with various bands. He becomes a bass player in a production of Hair, the musical.
Wow.
Yeah. Doesn't last very long because then this happened.
After 10 performances, Oldfield grew bored of the job and was fired after he decided to play his part for Let the Sun Shine In 7/8 time. How old is he at this point?
He would have been like 16 or 17.
Probably. Yeah.
See,
I can totally see like a 16-year-old musical prodigy would probably totally get bored. If you're in a band for a musical, you just play the same thing like once a night or twice a night. There's a matinee performance over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. And suddenly you're like, you know what? This would sound amazing in a different time signature. I'm going to try that.
Yeah, no, that must have fucked up everything.
I bet it did.
Aren't we mad there's no recording of that one night of that show?
Yes.
Like, wouldn't it be so good if someone just recorded that song? We need more recordings in this world.
Yes, lost to history. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that he goes around London with his demo tapes, tries to make people listen to them. At one point, he gets picked up as a bass player for a band that are recording an album at Virgin Manor. Richard Branson was trying to start the Virgin Record Company, and he has this huge manor and creates a recording studio, and then a band can come there and live for a week and record in the studio. Yeah. Mike Oldfield gets a gig as a bass player for one of these bands, and he goes to the producers with his demo tapes, and he's like, listen to this. Next day, did you listen to this? And finally they do, and they're like, wait a minute, this guy's good. And they say, okay, we'll produce your album, and he gets a week on his own at the manor. And they do a very foolish thing, which is they're like, okay, make us a list of all the instruments you need. And he basically puts down every instrument because he's taught himself to play guitar, bass, piano, everything. He wants everything in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. He gets a week at the manor to record it. After a week, he's not nearly done. So he stays on and then the next band comes in. And then when they're not recording, he goes back into the studio and keeps recording. And out of that comes this album that is so amazing, that is so rich, that is so complex and beautiful. Mike Oldfield is also painfully shy and introverted. So when it comes time to promote the album, this does not go well. Here's a little story.
But this poor bugger had the worst job in the world because he had to sell it. It wasn't like any other music that was playing at that time.
You know, having to try to get out and promote it with Mike not wanting to do any interviews at all.
So I did one. It was awful.
What, Melody Maker?
He asked me, why did you write Tubular Bells? I thought for about 20 minutes. And he was getting really upset and angry, you know, kind of impatient. Because I wanted to give him an honest answer. And in the end, I just couldn't come up with it. I don't know why, you know. It's like I didn't do it for a reason. It just kind of happened. And then after that, you know, I think, that was horrible. I'm not doing any more of these, you know.
I like the idea that he wanted to give an honest answer.
Yes.
It's very, like, endearing. That he's just like, I need to give you an honest answer. And they're like, no, just give us the first thing that comes to your head. We need to write it down.
Yeah. It's kind of the opposite of Tom Waits, right? I was reminded of our Tom Waits episode. And he will just give you the bullshit answer every time. Mm-hmm. That's his strategy, right? I thought that was hilarious. In order to promote the album, Richard Branson arranges a live performance of Tubular Bells.
How?
I know, right? He gets great musicians and they rehearse for it. And then the evening of, Mike Oldfield's like, I'm too nervous. I can't do it. He's very nearly having a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Branson knows that's what he's like, but this is the first album produced on Virgin Records. He kind of wants to sell some albums, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, okay, I just got an old Bentley. If you actually do the show, you can have it. Mike Oldfield says, okay, I'll do it. And here's what Mike Oldfield said afterwards.
Richard gave me his Bentley, so I would do it. But later, I discovered that the car cost more to repair than it was worth. Having been seen as some village idiot, I was suddenly everyone's greatest hero. So I went to live in the Welsh hillside surrounded by sheep. Aw, poor boy.
Yeah.
Was this the only thing he ever created? Did he just make this and was like, fuck this noise, I'm going to go hang out with the sheep?
No. So he goes to hang out with the sheep and he produces a lot of great albums. I like a lot of his early music, especially there's one called Hurgis Ridge. There's one called 5 Miles Out that I really enjoy. Great music, a lot of it. His most well-known record is Tubular Bells. Second most is the one called Crises that gave him an actual number one pop hit with Moonlight Shadow. I don't know if you heard that.
Nope.
Okay. Actual, honest to God, number one pop hit around the world. But I think there's no doubt that Tubular Bells is his first and his best work. And I don't know, how would you feel about that if the first thing you did was the best thing you'd ever done?
I would not like that.
Yeah, right?
That to me feels like a noose around your neck, like pulling you down, being like, you are never going to be as good as the first thing that you did.
Yeah.
I really like going back and watching my old competitions and all performances and seeing the growth.
Mm-hmm.
And like if, like, for example, the first thing I did was so much better than everything I'm doing now, then there's no growth. It's a decline.
Mm-hmm.
That would be very demotivating for me. I don't know. How did he respond to this?
Not terribly well, I don't think. Part of what he did was he also made a Tubular Bells 2 and a Tubular Bells 3.
No, that's not how you do it.
He also remastered it and tried to fix what he saw as mistakes in the original. He's done great music since then, in my opinion, but this is without a doubt his best work. And should it matter if your best work is your first work? It probably shouldn't, but I think it does.
I think it would. Yeah, you want to grow. You want to continue. Like, you don't have your magnum opus at freaking 19.
Exactly. He's still kicking around. He's approaching 70 now, living in the Bahamas. So he left the sheep behind.
That sounds like an upgrade. I mean, maybe musically he peaked, but it sounds like relaxation-wise, he's really finding the niche.
Exactly. Final thing about Mike Oldfield. What is Tubular Bells about? He actually said something on that.
I have got no patience for people who call it New Age or who go on about it being a concept album. It's not telling a story. There's no concept of anything. What it does have is extremes. Delicate mandolin sections. The pounding rock of the caveman section. The next section is the dreamiest little piece. And I also think people miss the humor in it. There's a honky-tonk piano with drunken people humming along. The sailor's hornpipe. It's got that Monty Python silliness. There's nothing like it before or since. Wow.
Yeah.
Yes. I like it. He's just like, stop trying to deconstruct it. Just enjoy it and actually enjoy it for what is there. There is so much there already. Don't deconstruct it. Don't add meaning. Don't make it weird.
Exactly. So he's awesome. The music is awesome. Another reason why I like this album is that it's such an unlikely hit, an unlikely success. And I like those stories.
Who doesn't like an underdog story? We all like an underdog story.
Exactly. And it's very much that. 19-year-old kid from a broken home comes in and creates this international hit. As I said, he had a hard time even finding a label, going around with his demos and nobody wanted to give him a chance. Then Richard Branson takes a chance and the record comes out and then it doesn't sell. Very, very modest sales. And it's no wonder there's no single, there's no songs on the albums. A quite challenging music and a creator who doesn't want to give interviews. So it doesn't sell very well. And then something happens. Katie, have you seen The Exorcist?
No. Why would I watch that film? It is a horror film. I am a marshmallow. We've talked about this.
Yeah. Yeah. As a teenager, I saw that the movie was on Danish television late at night, obviously. Why do they show horror movies late at night? They should show them in the middle of the day.
They shouldn't show them. Again, I keep trying to convince myself not to yuck someone else's yum, but horror movies are the fucking worst.
Yeah, and The Exorcist is pretty scary for its time. I tried to watch it on Danish television because I knew Mike Oldfield's music was in it, and I just couldn't. It was too scary. But the music got in there. I put a quote in the script on how that happened.
The decision to include the music was the result of pure chance. Director William Friedkin was visiting Atlantic Records and picked up a white label of the album from the selection of records in the office, put it on the record player, and instantly decided that the music would be perfect for the movie. Although the music only features briefly in two scenes in the movie, it has become the track most commonly associated with it. Oldfield has stated that he did not want to see the film because it would be... Sorry. Oldfield stated he did not want to see the film because he believed it he would find it too frightening. Me too, Oldfield. Me too.
Exactly.
What's a white label?
Before the record comes out. Before they have an actual album cover for it, that kind of thing.
Okay. Cool. Yep.
Yeah.
So he picked up, like, assumably a blank looking record and was like, what's this? Tubular Bells? Let's go. And then was like, oh, snap, this is the music I need to freak people out with. So when I said earlier, this music's either going to destroy the world or save the universe, it's destroying the world.
It is. That's what happens. Horror. Yeah. Yeah. That brings it to people's attention. And the record sells 50 million copies worldwide. And it's a huge hit.
Wow.
Yeah. And I found a very funny interview with Mike Oldfield talking about his success. So if you could read that.
Wait, he did another interview. That's very exciting for him.
Yeah, except that was later in life. He's actually gotten used to doing interviews now.
Aw,
yeah. Yeah.
Interviewer, did you ever call up record companies who rejected Tubular Bells and go, nah, 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 nah? Mike Oldfield laughs uproariously and then composes himself. I must say, I did once spend half an hour Googling the A&R men who booted me out the door, thinking I was a complete nutcase. I couldn't find any of them. Imagine that. Once Tubular Bells got to number one, they probably got the sack.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. Two more things that I love about this album is the Tubular Bells themselves. So the musical instrument, the Tubular Bells, the hanging metal cylinders that you strike with a hammer, are actually on the record. And that happened by complete coincidence. And that is actually a connection back to our episode on the song Hallelujah.
Oh, way.
Yeah. So what happens is that Mike Oldfield arrives for his week in the studio at Virgin Manors. Mm-hmm. And they're moving out the instruments from the previous musician, who was John Cale. Now, you'll remember John Cale from the Hallelujah episode because... just like with Tubular Bells, Leonard Cohen records the album that Hallelujah is on. It doesn't sell. Then John Cale makes a cover for one of his albums. Jeff Buckley hears John Cale's cover of Hallelujah. Jeff Buckley records that. Then he dies and it becomes a huge, huge hit.
There you go.
So here's John Cale. And John Cale had, as part of his recording, had Tubular Bells.
Ah, so it wasn't on the extensive list that Oldfield requested. He was just like, wait a minute, I didn't ask for Tubular Bells, but also I want them.
Yes, they're carrying them out, and he's like, put those back in, I need those. And they're like, whatever. And they actually became the name of the album, and also play a super important role in the ending of part one. I want to play you another little piece of music.
Grand piano.
piano.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that underlying theme? This announcer comes on and announces the next entrance of grand piano, mandolin, glockenspiel, two slightly distorted guitars. And then at the very end, we get the tubo bells. And I want you to just hear what they sound like.
It's so huge. You can feel like the world shaking a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's so huge.
Yeah. And that announcer voice, plus tubular bells, like super excited. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just love that. That gave the album its name. It gave the album its cover.
Is it the C with the bent thing on top? Yeah, it's on the YouTube video.
Yeah. Tubular bells don't look like that. They're straight. The designer, they got to create the cover. I was like, let's do a bent version. I actually got the record just for the cover. I thought that looked so sci-fi and weird, and I loved it, and that's why I bought it. I had no idea what it was.
For those of us who are listening on the podcast, the album is a picture of a crashing wave with a blue sky with clouds, and on top of that, superimposed, is a graphic drawing of a bent pipe in the shape of a triangle. It's very graphic. The lines are really thick and harsh, and it looks more like a cartoon on top of a photo, which is like a very jarring kind of image to have such a realistic photo with this very graphic design on top of it.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know why. It just spoke to teenage Alex.
Hey, man, I'm not going to question that.
Okay, final thing, Virgin. So this is the kickstart of the whole Virgin empire. This album becomes a huge hit. Virgin Records takes off, and from there you get Virgin everything else, right? Virgin Vodka, Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Banking, Virgin whatever. And without this album, all of that might not have happened. I think that that's pretty funny. It's also why they called one of the aircraft in the Virgin Atlantic fleet, one of the 747s, called the Tubular Bell, singular Tubular Bell, with an E at the end. Bell, yeah. Like a beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, exactly, right? The relationship between Mike Oldfield and Richard Branson was not always the best. There is a song on his record, Amarok, where there's this weird sound that comes in like... It actually turns out to be Morse code, and it says, fuck off, RB.
Wow. Wow, that's so harsh.
Yeah, they were not friends. During the actual recording... Richard Branson's like, so when are we going to get this record out? And is there any chance we could get a single off it? And Mike Oldfield becomes so enraged. He drinks half a bottle of whiskey. He goes into the recording studio and screams into the mic for an hour. And those lyrics became part of the caveman section of Tubular Bells. Yeah, so somewhat of a rocky relationship. Yeah. I think you could say that. Without Tubular Bells, there might not have been any of the Virgin stuff that we... know and feel pretty indifferent about these things.
Thank you for saying that, because I was like, girl, I don't care about Virgin Atlantic or Virgin anything.
Not a huge fan either. No. Virgin Vodka, Virgin Cola, come on. Virgin Fitness, Virgin Cell Phones, Virgin...
I've never purchased a Virgin product to my knowledge.
No, me neither. Me neither. All righty. So, Katie, now that you've heard the story of Tubular Bells, what do you think?
I think this is a very unique musical moment. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it is. Like, it feels very much of its time, of its place. It couldn't have happened in any other situation. And I love little narratives like this, little stories like this, where this exists and that's so fucking cool. And the circumstances that caused it to happen were so special and unique. That is fucking awesome. And I love that.
Yes. Compared to all the cookie cutter stuff that's been made, you know, in music history, this is none of that. And I urge everybody to give it a chance. Give it 4 or 5 chances. You're not going to like it on the first listen. I can pretty much promise that. If you do, you have excellent musical taste.
It is 48 minutes and 40 seconds. Oh, it's 48, 48. That's very satisfying. of time to be sitting listening to an album. So it's good for like rest days and like chill out time, zone out time.
Excellent chill out time. Knit something. Alrighty. So, dear listener, what do you think about Tubular Bells? Have you heard it? If you have, what do you think? If you haven't, when are you going to listen to it? Do you have any questions, or did we leave out something awesome about Tubular Bells or Mike Oldfield? Go to our website or Instagram at Electric Enthusiasm and leave us a comment.
Amazing. Okay. Today, for the moment of Mesa, I want to focus on that thing that we always say at the beginning, why it matters. Why does enthusiasm matter? Mm-hmm. The other day, I was scrolling through Instagram mindlessly, as I do, which is a terrible habit, and I really should stop doing it. But I came across a reel from a content creator who is a trauma therapist, and she was talking about reframing consent and talking instead about enthusiasm. So she says the way that she's going to teach her children, particularly her little boy, about consent is about being an enthusiasm detective, which I figured you'd vibe with that sentence.
I love it already. Say more.
So she talks about this idea of she doesn't want her son to engage in behavior unless he can be an enthusiasm detective. Is this person, are they smiling? Are their eyes lit up? Are they leaning towards you? Are they saying, yes, please? When you're engaging with someone in their physical body, you don't necessarily just want consent. You want enthusiasm.
Wow.
Because you never know what someone has been told about how much their body belongs to them. Like, are they looking down in a way? Are they still? Are they turning their body? Are they closing in on themselves? These are all nonverbal ways that somebody may have said, actively said the word, yeah, that's fine. But then they've done it like, yeah, that's fine. They've closed their body off. They've turned away. They're looking down. So encouraging people to consider the way that they can look for signs of enthusiasm and signs of excitement, as opposed to just waiting for the word yes.
Wow. That is such an interesting thought. This blows my mind. It's brilliant. It's so good. Also, we consent to a lot of stuff because we have to and not because we want to.
Mm-hmm.
There are places in life where that's fine. But when we're talking about bodily autonomy and intimate acts, just consenting because you kind of have to is not okay.
Yeah.
You would want people to be enthusiastic about what they're about to participate in.
Right?
Yes.
I remember another online creator, Hank Green, was talking about this. Their experience of the best sexual encounters are when both people are super into it and super excited about it, super enthusiastic towards it. Like, you want to be having encounters with people where they are as enthusiastic to be doing the thing that you're doing together as you are. If that enthusiasm isn't matched, that's not always the best situation. And it's really easy to be like, well, I guess. And so like looking for that enthusiasm in the other person and trying to have that enthusiasm detection. I love that sentence. Being an enthusiastic detective is a really great way of making sure that you're getting that active consent and making sure that checking in with yourself as well, making sure like, am I enthusiastic about this? Do I want to be doing this? I don't know. I just thought it was a really cool little moment, a little reel that I really appreciated. I will share it onto the Electric Enthusiasm Instagram page.
Yeah.
But I thought I'd also bring it to you because I figured you'd vibe.
No, this is brilliant. It's a radical shift from just, getting consent.
Yeah.
Because you can get consent in a lot of very unpleasant ways.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get enthusiasm in unpleasant ways. You can only get enthusiasm in good ways.
Exactly. We have to have a lot of conversations like, what is consent? If you're drunk, you can't consent. If you are unconscious, you can't consent. But like, if you're unconscious, you can't be enthusiastic.
Nope.
Unconscious people are not enthusiastic people.
Also, consent is a very low bar.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
Yeah, I consent to a lot of things. We're flying somewhere tomorrow. I do consent to going through security. Am I enthusiastic about it? Hell no. But you kind of got to take off your shoes and take out your iPad and that kind of thing.
Yeah, do the rigmarole.
Yeah. We consent to many things, but are we enthusiastic about them? No. And there are areas where that the consent is not enough. You want enthusiasm. Love it. Brilliant. Thank you for telling me about that. That was so cool.
I thought you'd appreciate that.
I'm very enthusiastic about it.
And so I want to encourage all of our wonderful listeners to be enthusiasm detectives and see enthusiasm in other people, because that's awesome.
Yes, it is. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Cool. Please share.
Yeah. And now, dear listeners, be like Mike Oldfield and run away to Wales and hang out with the sheep and tell the sheep about electric enthusiasm, because they might be really, really into this. In fact, tell everyone about electric enthusiasm, because you never know, they might also be super into this. Tell other people about your enthusiasm for our enthusiasm, and then everyone gets all enthusiastic together, and it's great and lovely, and I don't know how many times in a single sentence I can say the word enthusiasm before it starts sounding like nothing.
That was perfect. Alrighty. Katie, if somebody loved this episode of ours, what other episode of ours do you think they'd also enjoy?
I think any of the Marmite music episodes. I feel like we should make a new tag on the website. So you have like the squishy marshmallow stuff, which is me. And then we have the music Marmite stuff. Marmite music.
Yeah.
Hallelujah is obviously a great place to start. Tom Waits, also a great place to go.
Yeah.
One day we're going to have a meal composed of Marmite and marshmallows. I think I need to develop a recipe that's like the squishy marshmallow dessert.
Yeah.
And then some kind of like Marmite cheese toastie, because that's like Marmite and cheese are very good friends.
I've never developed a taste for the actual Marmite, just the music.
Ah, interesting. Have you had it with cheese?
I have not.
It complements cheese very well, I recommend. Anyways.
And so does Tubular Bells, the album. Roast great with cheese and red wine.
Oh yeah, yeah, I can see that. I can see that. A little cheese board while you listen to 48 minutes of insanity.
Why not? Why not? Alrighty, dear listener, we really, really hope you enjoyed sharing our enthusiasm for Tubular Bells in this episode. Please visit our website, electricenthusiasm.com, or find us on Instagram at electricenthusiasm to discover more episodes or to leave a comment.
And now, dear listener, go scream into a microphone about how much Richard Branson sucks.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.